Dit is Papa Alpha 00 November Echo Whiskey Sierra Papa Alpha 00 News. This is Papa Alpha 00 November Echo Whiskey Sierra Papa Alpha 00 News.
Attention bulletin stations, please note that this is an extended newscast and contains three breaks. Thank you. Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1828 with a release date of August 24th, 2012 to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. The FCC releases the text of its report to Congress on the role of amateur radio in emergency communications but provides no relief for hams living with deed restrictions or CC&Rs. Also, hams in Quebec, Canada get an implied exemption to that province's restrictive cell phone law. And we take you to the Huntsville Hamfest, where Aaron King, AK4JG, receives the 2012 Young Ham of the Year Award. Please join us on an extended amateur radio newsline report, number 1828, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, amateur radio's first independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now reporting from Mississippi, here is Don Wilbanks, AE5DW.
The FCC has released its long-awaited report to Congress into the uses and capabilities of amateur radio service communications in emergencies and disaster relief operations. It also delves into the existence of impediments to this aspect of personal communications. Amateur Radio Newsline's Don Carlson, KQ6FM, has the details.
Don't look for congressional action to override private land use restrictions, more commonly known as conditions, covenants, and restrictions, or CC&Rs, even if hams believe that these restrictions hamper them in times of emergencies. This is because in its report to the legislative body, the FCC says that, in its view, such restrictions do not constitute a significant impediment to ham radio or those in the United States Amateur Radio Service. In its report, the FCC noted that some of what it calls commenters recommend that CC&Rs be preempted if they prohibit antennas that are within certain limits. Others suggest that private land use restrictions on amateur antennas should be permitted only for safety considerations and not for aesthetic reasons. However, another group believes that it's not necessary to preempt private land use restrictions in order to promote amateur emergency communications. This, given the ways that even amateurs subject to CC&Rs can communicate effectively, and the nature of amateur emergency communications. Moreover, while commenters suggest that private land use restrictions have become more common, the FCC says that its own review of the record does not indicate that amateur operators are unable to find homes that are not subject to such restrictions. Therefore, at this time, the Commission does not see a compelling reason for it to revisit its previous determinations that preemption should not be expanded to CC&Rs. In relation to other impediments, the Commission says it has already preempted state and local regulations that do not reasonably accommodate amateur radio communications and do not represent the minimum practicable regulations to accomplish the local authority's legitimate purpose. The Commission says that it has also addressed regulations regarding possession and operation of amateur radio equipment while driving. These are state and local laws that prohibit cellular telephone and texting devices and are many times very broadly written as to catch hams, CB operators, and even commercial radio users into a confusing maze of legal webs. And as to any FCC rules that may be an impediment to various technical aspects of enhanced, read that as digital amateur service emergency communications, the FCC believes that these matters can be considered through the Commission's rulemaking process. Consequently, it does not believe that congressional action is necessary to address that issue either. On the other side of the coin, the FCC notes that the ham radio community and the emergency response and disaster communications communities all agree that amateur radio can be of great value in emergency response situations. The regulatory agency notes that amateur radio carries with it a wide range of advantages that allow it to supplement other emergency communication activities during disasters. This, says the FCC, has been demonstrated time and again in a wide variety of emergency and disaster situations, including Hurricane Katrina. But at this point, the regulatory agency sort of contradicts itself regarding CC&Rs, albeit it may not have noticed its own mistake. Here, the FCC notes that amateur radio emergency communications require not only stations in a position to originate the emergency message, but also as an alternative to the commercial communications infrastructure impacted by the emergency. This alternative infrastructure is the network of amateur radio operators and their stations that relay messages, build and maintain repeater stations and repeater networks, operate high-frequency message networks to send messages greater distances than are practical with mobile or transportable transmitters, and develop new technologies to improve the reliability of these networks. As such, the FCC contends that this value could potentially be increased through cooperation among Department of Homeland Security, Public Safety, Emergency Management, and amateur radio emergency communication associations and groups to develop future training protocols. But what the FCC fails or refuses to address is how radio amateurs living with CCRs that restrict or outright forbid antennas can possibly pass along emergency traffic using the high-frequency bands. It's not likely that a long wire or dipole hidden in Ham's attic is going to break through to any emergency net or pass traffic under adverse conditions. Operating effectively on the high-frequency bands requires decent outdoor antennas hung in the clear and is something that the FCC fails to address in this section of its report. Finally, the FCC recommends that the Department of Homeland Security work with state, local, and tribal authorities to develop disaster area access policies and qualifications for trained amateur operators who provide emergency communication support. The only question here is how you get the attention of these agencies, many of whom consider themselves autonomous and are not interested in assistance from the public at large. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Don Carlson, KQ6 FM in Reno.
You can download and read the entire 15-page FCC accounting to Congress at tinyurl.com/FCC-2-Congress-report. It's written pretty much in plain language and might well make an excellent program for radio clubs and on-air discussion nets. This is because it could easily set precedent in regulation of the United States amateur service for decades to come.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
A battle appears to be brewing between the Radio Society of Great Britain and the chairman of the European Union Committee. This after the latter attacked the RSGB's call to arms in the battle against powerline transmission radio pollution, a technology better known as broadband over powerline here in the United States. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, has more.
The chairman of the European Union Committee on Powerline Networking has responded to the Radio Society of Great Britain's call to arms, claiming that every minute of filibustering pollutes the radio spectrum more. According to the UK's newspaper The Register, the Radio Society of Great Britain says that the new standard for broadband powerline transmission will water down existing requirements. This, it says, will open the way to greater spectrum pollution. As such, the RSGB has asked members to lobby their local representatives. Ronald Storrs, chief of the committee defining the standards, refutes that. He claims that it is the RSGB that is risking the airwaves with, and we quote, their pointless protests and inflexible attitude. The problem is that sending data signals over unshielded mains wiring, as broadband over power line transmission does generate radio interference. And as the manufacturers push to increase speeds, that interference is spreading into the frequencies used by other radio services. That, says the RSGB, is unacceptable. But BPL or PLT equipment manufacturers have a totally different view. They say that the devices don't generate significant interference. Rather, it's the mains wiring is the culprit. The manufacturers also contend that in many homes, the wiring is sufficiently shielded that no interference is generated. As such, they will continue to sell their devices legally. Meantime, UK telecommunications regulator Ofcom has taken a back seat in this matter. It says that it can't do anything as the devices themselves aren't radio transmitters, so they fall outside their purview. Ofcom says it's waiting for the new standard to be enacted, which will give it some authority to regulate broadband over powerline technology. So it appears that the proverbial line has been drawn in the sand between the UK ham community, represented by the Radio Society of Great Britain, and those who want to sell broadband over powerline or PLT gear. And while the European Union Storrs agrees that BPL is generating unacceptable interference, he says that every day there isn't an acceptable standard in place, more unrestricted gear is getting into the marketplace. He adds that the pig-headedness of the United Kingdom's ham radio community isn't helping. For Amateur Radio Newsline, Norm Seeley, KI7UP in Scottsdale, Arizona.
You can read the entire Register article online at tinyurl.com/UK-PLT-fight. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the WB2 QLP repeater serving Naples, Florida.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
Ham radio has lost one of its most ardent supporters with the untimely passing of QST managing editor Joel Kleinman, N1BKE, who died in a house fire on Saturday, August 18th. Amateur Radio Newsline's Mark Abramovich, NT3V, has the details on this truly sad moment for all of us.
Neighbors of the Kleinman family were first to discover the fire that claimed the life of Joel Kleinman and left his widow, Jane, hospitalized. According to several news accounts, the fire inside Kleinman's Meriden, Connecticut home was pushing out heavy smoke when neighbors discovered it, and some of them raced into the burning dwelling. Reports say they first pulled out Kleinman's wife, Jane, who was already unconscious and is hospitalized at Mid-State Medical Center. Investigators say the rescuers saved her life. But news accounts quote the neighbors who were involved in the daring and dangerous action as saying the heavy smoke prevented them from reaching the second floor where Joel Kleinman was found by firefighters. The medical examiner says the 64-year-old Kleinman died of smoke inhalation, and he ruled the death accidental. Joel Kleinman had been the managing editor for the American Radio Relay League's QST magazine since 2001, but his history with the ARL goes all the way back to 1976 when he was hired by the organization to target young people with science and amateur satellites. A graduate of the University of Montana with a journalism degree, Kleinman, who didn't have a ham license at the time, embraced that role. It didn't take long for his ARRL bosses to recognize his skills, and he quickly moved into the operations of QST, where among the jobs he held was editorial assistant and features editor. By 1988, Kleinman was promoted to book team supervisor for ARRL's publications and other media. His return to QST as the top boss a few years later clearly was a recognition by the ARRL's management of his value to the monthly publication that reaches thousands of amateurs every month. QST editor Steve Ford, WB8IMY, called Kleinman, quote, the quiet man behind the scenes, shouldering much of the burden that comes with creating 164 pages of new content every month. Joel set a high standard for all who may follow him, unquote. ARRL President K. Craigie, N3KN, issued a statement, quote, with the passing of Joel Kleinman, N1BKE, we have lost not only a respected professional colleague, but also a friend, unquote. Kleinman was the former president of the Newington Amateur Radio Club and was a member of the Quarter Century Wireless Association. Funeral arrangements for Joel Kleinman were still pending as we were going to air. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Mark Abramovich, NT3V in Philadelphia.
Our hearts and prayers go out to the Kleinman family on this very tragic loss. The FCC has lowered a fine imposed on an unlicensed broadcaster, this after he provided proof that the initial amount would prove a hardship that he could not afford to pay. As previously reported, this past June 5th, the Enforcement Bureau's Tampa, Florida office issued a $15,000 notice of apparent liability for forfeiture to Albert R. Knighton, Jr. of Fort Myers, this for his alleged operation of an unlicensed radio station. In response to the proposed fine, Knighton admitted to and apologized for the violation. He also urged cancellation or reduction of the proposed $15,000 forfeiture, asserting that his financial situation could not permit payment of the fine that the FCC had levied against him. After examining the financial documents provided by Knighton, the FCC found sufficient basis to reduce the forfeiture to $1,200. However, it also cautioned Knighton that a party's inability to pay is only one factor in its forfeiture calculation analysis. It told him that it had previously rejected inability to pay claims in cases of repeated or otherwise egregious violations. In closing, it warned Knighton that future violations of this kind could result in significantly higher forfeitures that may not be reduced due to financial circumstances. Knighton was given the customary 30 days from the August 21st date of the order to pay the reduced forfeiture. If he fails to do so, the matter could be turned over to the Department of Justice for collection.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
The license holder of a low-power FM in Mission, Texas, will likely have to pay a $10,000 fine. This for its admitted failure to install and maintain working emergency alert system, or EAS, equipment. Amateur Radio Newsline welcomes George Bowen, W2XBS, who has this report.
Intercity Christian Youth Program Incorporated is the licensee for a low-power station KCYP. Responding to a complaint, agents from the Enforcement Bureau's Houston, Texas office inspected the station this past March. At that time, the manager admitted to the agents that the station had operated without EAS gear since the facility went on the air in 2007. KCYP also had no EAS logs to document that the facility had ever had such gear installed or that it had ever conducted the required weekly or monthly EAS tests. The base fine for not having operational EAS gear is $8,000. The commission tacked on another $2,000 because it appears the station had not had working EAS gear for the better part of 5 years. The station has 30 days to pay the fine or to file an appeal. KCYP must provide a sworn statement to the Houston office of the Enforcement Bureau certifying that it now has EAS equipment installed. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm George Bowen, W2XBS, in Albany, New York.
According to the FCC, every broadcast station is part of the nationwide Emergency Alert System Network and is categorized as a participating national EAS source. This in turn means that all stations must ensure their EAS encoders and decoders are installed and working properly. Romaine Davis, who local Florida police say operated an unlicensed radio station, is now free on bond. Police say Davis operated an illegal station out of a warehouse since March using a laptop running iTunes. The investigation began in July when a listener to American Public Media's classical South Florida WKCP FM in Miami complained that rap music was interfering with the legitimate signal on 89.7 megahertz. Police recovered a computer, transmitter, and other gear, which they said was used to broadcast the unauthorized station on an adjacent frequency of 89.5 megahertz. Unlike the FCC, which normally issues fine for unlicensed operations, under Florida's strict state law regarding unauthorized transmissions, Davis, who had turned himself into authorities, could face up to 5 years in prison for his unlicensed station operation. Public comments to the FCC about the best way to collect regulatory fees from the industries that the agency oversees are due in mid-September. The agency notes that a lot has changed in the telecommunications marketplace since its current system for assessing and collecting regulatory fees was enacted in 1994. Back then, commission regulation centered mostly on wired, local, and long distance. Since then, the wireless industry exploded, shifting agency resources to that industry. Complicating things further, telephone companies have entered the video market. Cable operators are winning voice customers, satellite operators offer competitive radio, television, and broadband services, and wireless services abound. Comments to MD Docket 12-201 are due September 12th. Payment of the existing fees for this year are due by September 13th. This commentary period does not apply to amateur radio or other personal radio services. In a case involving the possibility of bird collisions with towers, the FCC has decided in favor of both the tower and its owner, American Tower Corporation. Amateur Radio Newsline's Skeeter Nash, N5ASH, reports.
Last April, Michael Pearson of Marshall, Arkansas, raised several issues before the commission related to a 314-foot structure registered to American Tower that was under construction in the area. American Tower suspended construction while the Emergency Petition to Compel Compliance Order was reviewed. In his petition to the FCC, Pearson said that because the tower would be in wooded and pasture land area, and also within 4,000 feet of a wildlife management area, that the tower could negatively affect migratory birds and endangered species. This included mountain lions, bobcats, and even skunks. But in giving American Tower the green light to resume construction, the FCC said his complaint did not meet the standard for requesting environmental review. It said that Pearson didn't identify endangered species that could be specifically affected by the tower. Rather, he had listed non-endangered species in the area. Possibly more important, the FCC also stated that the proximity of a tower to a wildlife management area does not, by itself, mean that a structure may have a significant effect on the environment. As previously reported, environmental assessments are now required for proposed new towers over 450 feet above ground level, for replacement or modification of existing structures over 450 feet that involve a major size increase, or for certain lighting changes to towers over 450 feet tall. This decision is very significant, as it gives insight as to how the agency will likely handle these cases in the future. I'm Skeeter Nash, N5ASH.
As we go to air, it's unknown if Pearson will accept the FCC's decision or if he will appeal it up the administrative procedures chain. With you 52 weeks a year, every year since 1976, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being brought to you by the following volunteer bulletin station.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
This note to those of you who still receive these newscasts over our 661-296-2407 dial-in line rather than downloading the MP3 file from our website. Of late, we've noticed a major decline in the number of those calling into it, and as such, we're giving consideration to discontinuing it by year's end. But before we do, we want to know how many people are actually using it. If you are one of those who call in each week on the phone, please send us a note telling us who you are and the reason you're using telephone access rather than simply downloading the newscast from the Internet. Our address is the Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. Or you can email us at newsline@arnewsline.org, and we look forward to hearing from you. Get ready for the first 2-meter, 70-centimeter dual-band mobile selling for under $225, including shipping. At least that's the price being quoted in an online advertisement from the Hong Kong-based 409 shop for the new Baoji model BJ-UV55 dual-band mobile radio. Like its Japan-built counterparts, the BJ-UV55 has most of the features one expects from a basic dual-band mobile. The radio features a large, blue, backlit LCD display that shows both frequencies programmed in it at the same time. The transmitter runs 35 watts out on 70 centimeters and 45 watts on 2 meters. The manufacturer claims a receiver sensitivity of between 0.18 to 0.22 microvolts, depending on selected bandwidth. 128 memory channels, both CTCSS and digital CTCSS tone encoding, a DTMF microphone, and even a built-in FM broadcast band receiver. The negative on this radio is that nowhere in the advertisement is there any mention of the Baoji BJ-UV55 being FCC certified, either under Part 15 or Part 90, making it illegal to import to the United States, nor is there any service or repair station in the United States. That means returning a radio to the China-based manufacturer should it require maintenance. And as with any product purchased from a non-United States dealer, this can be more expensive than the price of the radio itself. You can see this new dual bander online at tinyurl.com/baoji-dual-band-mobile. And you spell Baoji, B-A-O-J-I-E. And as we say, with anything purchased from an overseas dealer, be certain that it's legal to import and use here in the United States. And even more important are the two words caveat emptor, which of course means buyer beware. Thomas Giella has announced that his NZ4O medium frequency, high frequency, and 6-meter radio wave propagation forecast is now published on a daily basis. It can be found online at www.solarcycle24.org and www.wcfl.unatall.com/propagation.htm. Thomas notes that each new edition will be available at around 1300 UTC, but that there will be no daily email notice about its being posted. Just check the websites for the daily updates. And, of course, you can check the print edition of the Amateur Radio Newsline for those URLs. North Carolina's Charlotte Observer reports that the 1,500 hotel rooms in Gaston County are solidly booked because of the Democratic Party's national convention and a rather famous amateur radio hamfest. The newspaper says that the Shelby Hamfest takes place Labor Day weekend, September 1st and 2nd. Meantime, the 2012 Democratic National Convention is being held in the city of Charlotte from September 3rd to the 6th. And while no delegates to the convention are staying in Gaston County, there are support people such as FBI agents, U.S. and foreign media, and peripheral groups such as lobbyists who need places to stay. The annual Shelby Hamfest is one of the nation's best-attended amateur radio events. It's held at Biggerstaff Park in Dallas, North Carolina. The paper says that in 2011, about 12,800 ham radio enthusiasts from 30 states showed up. Many camped in RVs, but lots more stayed in local hotels. More on the Hamfest is online at ShelbyHamFest.com. Members of the Symbol Technologies Amateur Radio Club will once again be operational as N1Y September 8th and 9th. This in commemoration of those who lost their lives in the September 11th, 2001 Al-Qaeda-led terrorist attacks that fell the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. N1Y will be operating on 40, 20, and 15 meters using CW and SSB in the general portions of those bands. A special QSL may be had by sending an SASE to W2SBL at the address found on QRZ.com.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
Despite a small war in Tajikistan, a pair of road rally enthusiasts have reached Mongolia. Neil Melville, PA9N, and Helen Woolnow, driving their 9-year-old 1.1-liter Fiat Panda, are taking part in the Mongol Rally, where participants drive in no more than 6 weeks from the United Kingdom to Ulaanbaatar in Mongolia, using a thoroughly unsuitable car of 1.2 liters or less. Woolnow and Melville's entry is called the Uncertainty Principle, and they started on their epic journey from the UK on July 14th. On Sunday, August 19th, their location was given as 46.37 north, 96.25 east, placing them near their goal. The pair are driving the race to raise money for the Lotus Children's Center Charitable Trust and UNICEF. By the time the event ends, they will have covered more than 10,000 miles through 19 countries with no outside support. Over the years, PA9N has given many presentations to the AMSAT UK International Space Colloquium in Guildford, England. His first spacecraft project was the Express Oscar 53 satellite, better known as XO-53. Here on Earth, you can follow their route and blog at theuncertaintyprinciple.co.uk. The British Broadcasting Corporation is undertaking a 5-week trial of switching off existing medium-wave services for 4 BBC local radio stations. The experiment runs from the 17th of August to the 24th of September and affects BBC Radio Kent, BBC Radio Lincolnshire, BBC Radio Merseyside, and BBC Radio Nottingham. The BBC say one way to make savings and preserve value to licensee fee payers is to switch off medium-wave services except where listeners depend upon medium-wave as an alternative to FM or digital audio broadcasting. Medium-wave services in the UK mainly duplicate what's already available on FM and DAB, and most listeners will be able to hear their local stations on FM. Medium-wave is a European term that describes what we call the AM broadcast band here in the United States. The BBC notes that the aim of the trial is to get a better understanding of the impact the loss of medium-wave would have on its core listeners and also enable the broadcaster to ensure adequate coverage is available on other platforms in these regions. This is Ham Radio News for today's Radio Amateur from the United States of America. We are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following Radio Amateur.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
Some good news for hams living in the Canadian province of Quebec. A 4-year-old law banning the use of cellular phones while driving now has an implied exemption for those using two-way radio gear, including radio amateurs. Amateur Radio Newsline's Heather Butera Howell, KB3TZD, has the latest.
According to a news release from Radio Amateurs of Quebec, the ban on the use of cellular telephones while driving came into force in April of 2008. Since that time, different police departments have issued tickets for the use of various types of devices, leaving it up to each department to determine what could be construed as a mobile telephone system. Those who have received these tickets have vigorously contested them. But over the years, the various courts hearing these cases have expanded considerably on what they believe the meaning of the law was, to include a multitude of communications equipment far from cellular telephones. Now, after 4 years of uncertainty, the situation has now been clarified by amendments to the Highway Safety Code, which came into effect this past June 6th. A new article of the code simply states that no person may, while driving a road vehicle, use a handheld device that includes a telephone function. More importantly, the first paragraph does not apply to a two-way radio or cordless communication device, which does not allow the parties to speak simultaneously. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Heather Butera Howell, KB3TZD, near Berwick, Pennsylvania.
According to the new version of the law, for the purposes of enforcement, a driver in Quebec who is holding a handheld device that includes a telephone function is presumed to be using the device. This prohibition does not apply to drivers of emergency vehicles in the performance of their duties. NASA's Mars Science Laboratory at JPL team has sent a software update to the Curiosity rover on Mars, more than 160 million miles away. According to VentureBeat.com, the software had to be updated because Curiosity needed different directions to drive around on Mars than it did to land on the planet's surface. The computer hardware on the Curiosity rover is powered by a pair of computers built by BAE Systems. These RAD750 computers use a 10-year-old IBM PowerPC microprocessor running at a relatively slow 132 MHz. These machines also have only 120 MB of random access memory, but are built to withstand wild temperature swings, radiation, and physical shaking. The drawback is that the computers on the robot vehicle did not have enough memory for both the landing and its surface missions, so NASA had to swap out the software over 4 days of communication through the void of space. It took so long because it takes about 14 minutes to send the signal to the rover and another 14 minutes to get a response back. NDX, K7BV, having recovered from a serious medical condition, is returning to Asia for a short visit between August 25th and September 2nd. He'll be using his HS0ZKS call sign on the HF bands from the home of HS1CHB and hopes to QSO friends from around the world. He may also get on the air from Japan as well using his call JF1XJR. QSL via K7BV's new address at 290 West Road, Turkey, North Carolina, 28393. W7XA will be active stroke DU1 through August 27th from near Tagaytay Ridge, which is about 40 miles south of Manila in the Philippines. His operation is on 20, 17, and 15 meters using mostly CW and some SSB. QSL via his home call as found on QRZ.com. OE4JHW will be operational as 8Q70E from the Maldives between September 3rd and the 14th. Activity will be holiday style on 40 through 10 meters using SSB and BPSK. He'll focus on stations from DL, HB0, HB9, and OE, as well as on North and South America. QSL via his home call, direct or by the Bureau, also electronically using either Logbook of the World or EQSL. And lastly, CT1FJZ says that he is now in Angola and is expected to be there for 1 year working in Benguela and Huambo. Look for him to be active as D2FJZ, mainly on the weekends and limited times during the weekdays. Activity will be on 80 through 10 meters SSB, QSL to his home call, by the Bureau, or direct.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
And finally this week, we want to take a moment to congratulate 18-year-old Erin King, AK4JG, on receiving her award as the 2012 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year. The ceremony was held at the Huntsville Hamfest, where I had the honor of being the award presentation MC, but it was truly AK4JG's moment to shine.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to introduce to you a very impressive young lady. This is Erin King. She is your 2012 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year. Erin, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Don. Thanks to everyone who's like helped made this possible. When I did my project with the tube and all the ham radio stuff that I've been doing, I had no idea that it was going to bring me this far. I had no idea that I was going to have the opportunity to earn this award or that any of this would be possible. It's been a lot of fun. I've been a ham for like 4 years now, and I've learned so much, and I've met a ton of great people, and ham radio has become a really, really integral part of my life, and it's part of one of the primary reasons that I'm making the decisions that I'm making in the future that I'm going to have. So it's all very exciting. I'm very excited to be here and to earn this award. So thank you very much.
The Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award is jointly underwritten by Yaesu USA Corporation, CQ Publishing, and Heil Sound. Yaesu has been with the award since its inception some 27 years ago. This year, the company was represented by its Executive Vice President of Amateur Radio Sales and Marketing, Dennis Machenbacher, K7BV.
Hi, Erin.
Hi.
And congratulations from Yaesu.
Thank you.
We don't want you to go off the air as you're traveling around with all of your schooling and all that. And we want you to have a radio you can get on the air with no matter where you go. And that would be our portable FT817ND. We hope you'll pack that in your bag and take it with you all the way to your CEO position with a Fortune 500 company sometime soon. Okay? Congratulations.
Thank you.
Part of the award is an expense-paid trip to Space Camp Huntsville, courtesy of CQ Publishing. CQ Magazine editor Rich Moses and W2VU took a bit of time to comment on the quality of those nominated.
We've had a tremendous time being involved with the Young Ham of the Year Award, and I've been honored to be one of the judges ever since we became involved, and the quality of the young people who are nominated is just wonderful and makes me very, very optimistic for the future of our hobby. And this is year after year.
And last, but by no means least, the award's newest corporate sponsor, Heil Sound. Not only did founder Bob Heil, K9EID, present Erin with a pair of the company's new headphones, he also gave her a very special invitation to appear with him on his Twit TV program, Ham Nation.
Well, we're so happy for you, and we want to stay in touch with you as you get through all of the wonderful things that happen in ham radio.
All right.
Come and visit us on Ham Nation, and I really hope that we can have you as a guest real soon.
And there you have it for yet another year, the 27th consecutive year that this award has been presented, and the 19th consecutive year that the presentation has been made at the Huntsville Ham Fest. And in that regard, we want to express our thank you to Charlie Emerson, N4OKL, and his team that puts on this annual event, and to Dave Bell, W6AQ, who sponsors the Young Ham of the Year plaque, and also to Tom Medlin, W5KUB, who live-streamed the presentation over the Internet for all to see on W5KUB.com, and to Gary Pierce, KN4AQ of Amateur Radio Video News, who video-recorded it for posterity. We thank you all. And with thanks to Allen Labs, AMSATH, ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGB, the Southgate News, Twit TV, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. You can find more information at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, that's at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. So for now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF, at the editor's desk in Los Angeles, from South Mississippi, I'm Don Wilbanks, AE5DW, saying 73, and we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2012. All rights are reserved.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
We'll climb into the August 18th, 2012 rain report in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. From the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, with a rain report that will challenge your fear of heights. Every year we learn of folks who are severely injured and sometimes killed as a result of climbing a tower. One ham who has been climbing towers for almost 50 years is Phil Theis, K3TUF. Phil presented a paper at the 2012 Dayton Hamvention entitled Tower Climbing, Safety, and Rescue. This week, we bring you the first of two excerpts from his talk.
When I was climbing as a younger person, I did some really crazy things, and I'm sure you could all tell us some stories about climbing 200 and some feet, free climbing, and I know you've all seen the video at 1,700 feet with free climbing. That's nuts. I don't do this for a living. I never did, but I'm a certified tower climbing and rescue. I want to propagate keeping us all safe. So let's talk about the negatives. What should we look out for? The hazards. There's three areas we'll cover. First, environmental. In terms of rules, wind, I have a threshold. You can set your own threshold. My threshold somewhere in the single digits. If it's going to be 15 miles per hour or higher, I don't like to climb. It's not that it's not safe, but you'll have your own personal threshold where you're not comfortable climbing. Moisture, rain, absolutely not. You never climb when the tower is wet. Lightning, I can recall being in Florida doing some tower work. That was in the 70s. In Florida, in Orlando, we would be doing some work, and certainly in the afternoon, we'd see the storm coming off in the distance. We'd have to come down and come back later. Sun is a real hazard in terms of sunscreen, long sleeve shirts, etc. Live hazards. Last year, when I first went climbing to do a little bit of work, that's a rotating tower. There's the guy ring. I had secured above the guy ring. Then I got stung in the nose, and I look and saw the swarm. I had to reach up and unconnect myself from that hornet's nest. It wasn't that big when I first did that, but 1 week later when I finally get rid of it, it was that big. On the ground, you have to be careful. Snakes, rodents, probably one of the most dangerous hazards you have to look out for, perhaps, is humans. What are they doing on the ground? What are they doing? Be careful. And the bottom line is, do an assessment. Is it safe? Is there any hazard you need to look out for? And set your rules for climbing in terms of wet. Structural hazards, look out for. If it's your tower, you're probably going to be in good tune with what the condition is. But if you're going to climb somebody else's tower, you want to inspect every guy anchor. You look at the point of daylight. That's the point where it actually comes out of the ground. Check the turnbuckles, guy tension, and you don't have to put the loose gauge on there, but make sure that it's not swaying. Look at the coating. Has a rust taken over, or are there any real dangerous parts that you should perhaps not climb? And then, is the tower plumb? If it's leaning, you want to find out why. Is it torqued or turned? Those are hazards, and you really don't want to climb.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo Whiskey Sierra, Papa Alpha 00 News.
Tools, particularly what you're going to learn a little bit about, your protective equipment. Are they in good condition? Are your hand tools in good condition? You don't want your pliers to fall apart. Just basic common sense stuff here. Most importantly, what is the plan? Put your techniques together. Do you have an idea? Run through that in your head. I'm often doing this a day or two ahead of time before any of the assisting crew is going to show up. Make sure that you know all the tasks you're going to do, and then make sure everybody that's there helping you or doing the work knows what the task at hand will be. And, of course, be sure you take everything that you need along with you. It's a real downer if, we need something, you have to wait for it to be brought up, and you certainly don't want to have to go down and get it yourself. These are the tools and the tasks that we'll go over. Rigging, rope is very important. And block and tackle, you want to make the work as simple as possible. You want to give yourself every advantage that you possibly can. Know your knots. There's whole books on knots. These are two basic knots, the bowline, the overhand knot that you'll use. Gin pole, use that to, again, accelerate and give yourself the advantage of building a tower if you're putting it together. And a lot of times when you're putting antennas up, replacing antennas, just last Saturday, we replaced a 6-meter beam at my place. I had to get a 50-foot boom up there. Using the right tools is very important. Winches are very helpful. An alternative to winches is a good ground crew, definitely more than one person on the load rope when you're pulling it up. But if you can get your hands on a capstan winch, that's a great tool to have. Lay out your hand tools, make sure they're safe. One thing I wanted to add here, I always take water up with me. You don't know how long you're going to be. Hydrating is very important. We don't often think of that as we're younger, but I know we think of it more as we age. And if I know I'm going to have a long session, I'll even take some snacks up, some crackers. That way, while you're waiting for some of the work down below for the next phase, you get a little nourishment. It's just only going to help you. This is a comfort thing. Some people don't use belts, but a nice bag, they're real handy. Okay, the climb itself, let's talk about that. First of all, in getting in shape, it's very important that you do a little bit of exercise before. Stretching is important. You don't want to cramp when you're up on the tower. You might be contorting into some very difficult directions. So a good set of stretches before you go up is very important.
You're listening to a 2012 Hamvention Talk by Phil Theiss, K3TUF. A veteran tower climber who's been climbing antenna towers for almost 50 years. We'll conclude the first excerpt from his talk in a moment. This is the Rain Report, available on Twitter.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo Whiskey Sierra, Papa Alpha 00 News.
Another thing that you really have to concentrate on is climbing with your legs, not your arms. You've probably seen that written down. But the tendency is always going to be that you want to clasp yourself close to that tower. It's your safety. And so the tendency is always to pull yourself up with your arms, but you don't want to overuse at different times those muscles in your arms because you want to save that energy and you don't want your arms to cramp. You have to concentrate on this and actually say, I'm climbing with my legs. My arms are just here to keep me close to the tower. That's something you really need to work on. Another thing is pausing and resting frequently. You'll get your own rhythm as to when you want to pause, and I use my pulse. I know that I can tell when my heart is racing at a little faster speed, so I'll go maybe 20 feet. I know I've got a little bit of pulse, and then I'll pause as soon as my pulse goes down. But you can use your own methods. Good deep breaths. It's always just very good for feeding the whole skeletal muscular system. And always wear all of your protective equipment. Even more important than that is being connected. That's out with the old. You don't free climb. No exception to that. And the work. I'm going to go through just a few slides here using techniques that make the work easier. Slings are a great tool to have. It's very inexpensive. You get a little $1 clip and some good, simple, easy-to-use rope with some loops, and you have them with you. They're very easy to put on and take off. Very handy tools to get the work job done. Using tram lines, we won't get into detail about that. This is just a high level to say, use methodologies that are going to make your work accomplished safer. So how about the safety equipment? Let's get into that. First, a first aid kit. Make sure one is on site and everybody knows where it is. It wouldn't be a bad idea to have somebody around that's capable of CPR, but it's priceless if an accident happens. You've got to have one around. Then hard hats. Hard hats for everybody, the ground and the tower. So, oh, I don't need them when I'm climbing the tower. Well, it's not just because I don't have a lot of natural protection, but I can smack my head very easily. Antennas are outside the scope of the width of the tower. You could bump into that. I mean, it all depends on what is on your tower, but you really need to have a hard hat, and especially those on the ground. Foot protection, very important in terms of the shank, and especially for the ground crew, because things could fall, could be dropped, an antenna, a boom, and so forth. Gloves. I always wear gloves, even in the summertime, even when it's warm. Your hands are your most valuable tool, so you've got to protect your tools. Safety glasses. Earplugs, I'd say, are optional. If you're not going to do anything that's loud, but if you're going to be drilling, earplugs, skin protection, very, very important. I would recommend using long sleeves, even in the summer, long pants. You're going to get less scrapes. You're not going to be scraped. And most important, sunscreen. If you're going to be outside, put the sunscreen on. My own personal reason for that is, as you get older, I'm told now by the doctor, as I have my skin cancer, it's because you had too much sun when you were younger. So you that are younger, don't think you shouldn't have sunscreen. Everybody should have sunscreen.
This concludes the first of two excerpts we'll be bringing you from a 2012 Dayton Hamvention talk given by veteran tower climber Phil Theis, K3TUF. We'll hear more about tower climbing safety next time. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2012 Rain, all rights reserved. Now for everyone connected with the Radio Amateur Information Network, I'm Kent Peterson, KC0DGY, bidding you a very 73 from The Rain Report, www.therainreport.com.
This is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo, Whiskey, Sierra, Papa Alpha 00, News.
Iedere vrijdagavond om 20:30 in Midden-Nederland zendt PA00 Nieuws uit met wereldwijd amateurnieuws in het Engels. De frequentie is 145.4625 MHz, maar als de frequentie rond het starttijdstip bezet is, kan een andere frequentie nabij dit kanaal gekozen worden. PA00 Nieuws is een initiatief van PA0ETE. De bedoeling is om zo te kijken of er belangstelling voor iets dergelijks bestaat. Het is niet uitgesloten dat er bij voldoende belangstelling in de komende maanden ook nieuws in het Nederlands zal worden gebracht. De uitzendingen zijn vooralsnog een experiment. Als de belangstelling gering is, dan is het een tijdelijk experiment. Het is niet de bedoeling om een uitgebreide presentielijst te gaan voeren, maar na afloop, rond 9:15, 9:30 of iets later, afhankelijk van het nieuwsaanbod, wordt er zeker met belangstelling uitgeluisterd naar mogelijke aanroepen.
Dit is Papa Alpha 00, November Echo Whiskey Sierra, Papa Alpha 00 News.